The Magician's Son by Barrington J. Bailey.
There have been goblins hereabouts, Muinchbeck said. I can smell them, by Manon.
Smell them? Vukotich, his younger companion, shifted uneasily and looked about him.
How do you smell them? What do they smell like?
Oh, you wouldn't be able to do it.
Muinchbeck was peering through the trees, bulky in his thick leather jerkin and brass-studded morion. The trail was slight, and the forest dense. Earlier in the day there had been bright sunlight, but now a mist had descended, and the gloom and darkness of endless wilderness lay all about.
I didn't think to find them this far south, the Marienburger said gruffly. Oh well, we'd better keep moving.
Vukotich didn't like the situation and hung back. Muinchbeck, when he did not hear the tread of his buskins behind him, stopped again and looked back, battle axe resting on his shoulder. His white teeth showed through his beard in a mirthless grin.
What's the matter? Are you afraid now?
He raised his arm and pointed back along the trail.
Back to Middenheim, then. Beg in the gutter. Better still. Try your luck in Britannia, or some place like that. Wade in farm muck, minding pigs and chickens. Perhaps that's what you're used to.
And he turned his back and went lumbering on. After a few moments, Vukotich followed. Muinchbeck's taunt had made him angry. He'd never told Muinchbeck much about his early life, other than that he'd spent some of it in Kislev. But it was not advisable to walk alone in a goblin-haunted forest. Vukotich had been wandering the streets of Middenheim, looking for work as a hired sword, when he'd had the good luck, though, as dusk began to press, he was not sure it had been good luck at all, to meet up with the mercenary Muinchbeck, himself having just arrived in Middenheim after taking part in some kind of trouble somewhere, and also looking for work. But pickings in Middenheim were thin. On hearing of a campaign against the East being prepared in Kislev, Muinchbeck had decided to try his luck there, and it struck him that Vukotich, with his acquaintance of the region, would make a useful companion in arms. Vukotich hadn't much liked the idea of journeying back to Kislev, which he'd been only too keen to leave behind him, but Muinchbeck had persuaded him. Actually, they were eating better now than they had in Middenheim. The forest had plenty of game, and both men were expert trappers and hunters. But though his belly was full of venison, Vukotich felt an empty sensation in his stomach as he paced after his companion, taking the precaution as he did so to fasten his bowstring. The trail swerved north and passed by a tumble of stone and rock. Muinchbeck paused. He raised his head and sniffed.
They're here, he hissed. If I can smell them, they can smell us.
And at that moment, something came scrambling over the rocks that reared over their heads to the left. They were green as moss, green as green leaves, as if they had grown like a vegetable cancer in the forest. Squat and burly, lower jaws fanged, toad-like skin rippling with muscles. For weapons, they carried small swords and cudgels, studded with spikes, blades and slivers, which Vukotich saw come tumbling down on him. There were three of them. Vukotich dropped his bow and snatched his sword from its scabbard. Muinchbeck's great battle-axe was already swinging, biting into the shoulder of the first goblin, who grunted and gobbled with pain, ichor blood gushing to the ground. The creature rolled aside, leaving Muinchbeck to its two companions and making for Vukotich, swinging its fearsome cudgel into its left hand. For an instant, Vukotich froze. He knew now what Muinchbeck meant by the smell of goblin. Its blood, its sweat, had an overpowering tang, like crushed ants, like pickled melon gone bad, like an apothecary's acid that tickled the nostrils and made one hold one's breath. He sidestepped to avoid the cudgel's spikes and jabbed at the creature's left arm, hoping to incapacitate it, but produced no more than a rivulet of dark blood from the timber-hard bicep. He heard a throaty rumble, saw the great mouth gape, and then a forest of spikes was hurtling for his face. Instinctively, he brought up his sword, and at the same time ducked. The bludgeon flew past, one iron spike coming within a hair's breadth of gouging out his eye, and after it came the goblin, the heavy, clammy body, striking him and carrying him to the ground. It took him a moment to realize that the goblin was motionless, that it was, in fact, dead, the blood from its wounded shoulder dripping over his jerkin. He struggled to free himself and stood up. A very long, light green arrow protruded from the goblin's back. Where it came from, he had no time to think, for he saw that Munchbeck was hard-pressed, keeping his two attackers at bay with wide sweeps of his axe. The Marienburger had his short broadsword in his left hand, moving like a dancer to prevent them from bracketing him. But the goblins knew something of footwork, too. Suddenly, one was behind him, weapon raised for the death blow. Vuketich snatched up the fallen goblin's bludgeon and brought it down with all his might on the flat green head. The spikes went into the goblin's skull with a crunch all the way to the timber. The club was wrenched from Vuketich's grasp as, still standing, its own weapon still raised, the creature turned to look at him. The expression on its face was one of surprise, almost puzzlement. The bludgeon balanced on its head like a hat. Then the tip of Muinchbeck's broadsword appeared briefly from its burly chest. Then the tip of Muinchbeck's broadsword appeared briefly from its burly chest, like the flicker of a snake's tongue, and the goblin toppled like a fallen tree. A breathless laugh came from Muinchbeck. "It's hard to kill a goblin by hitting it on the head. They can fight with half their brain gone. Thanks for your help, comrade." Behind him, the third goblin lay sprawled, its torso hacked open in several places. To make sure, Muinchbeck stepped to it and chopped through its neck. "Someone helped us," Vuketich said, pointing to the arrow that had saved him. Muinchbeck stared at it. "An elf arrow, made of the Lorna limb wood they use." They both stared up the trail. At first, there seemed to be nothing. Then, as if condensing out of the mist, a slim figure appeared and sauntered towards them. As it came nearer, Vuketich saw the longbow, the fletches of tall arrows, the pointed ears, and the honey-coloured skin. The elf glanced at the goblin corpses. "Well done," he said, in a cool, distant voice. "Though I do not think you have dealt with them all." Muinchbeck was clearly uneasy. "We owe you thanks," he said gruffly. "But what brings you here?"
"I have been following you for over a day."
"Why?"
"Curiosity. I sense entertainment."
The elf spoke Reichsspiel, the common dialect of the Empire, with an incisive, too correct accent. Muinchbeck grunted, but whatever he might have replied was cut off by a loud moan from the other side of the rock pile. He cautioned Vuketich to silence, and together they padded towards the stones.
"Do not fear," said the elf loudly. "It is another of your kind."
Muinchbeck and Vuketich forced their way through the bushes and up a bank to come out behind the rock pile. There they discovered a man, bound and gagged, lying on the ground and glaring pleadingly at them. To Vuketich, he seemed about Muinchbeck's age, perhaps a bit younger, his hair lank, his beard white and bushy. He wore a long, grey-belted cloak,
decorated with arrow designs, and a brimmed hat. The goblins had not bothered to strip him when they tied him up, and he attempted desperately to speak through the gag when his rescuers found him.
"My son!"
he gasped when Muinchbeck removed the cloth from his mouth.
"Please, you must help me get my son back!"
"Calm yourself!"
Muinchbeck stood while Vukotic cut the man's bonds with his knife. He clambered to his feet, rubbing his chafed wrists. He was tall, thin, and slightly stooped.
"The goblins have him. We must not delay. Rescue, sirs, rescue, I beg of you."
"Tell us who you are, and what has happened."
"I am Roderick Semperfilius, at your service, sirs. We were travelling from Kislev to our home in Talabheim, when the goblins took us. We were told these woods were safe."
A look of agony crossed his features.
"They were taking me off as a thrall, but my boy, they meant to have sport with. You must help me, before it is too late."
He was quaking with fear and anxiety. With pale blue eyes, he looked straight into the eyes of Muinchbeck.
"You must help me. You must help me. You must help me. You must help me."
Muinchbeck's eyes became empty and vacant, and the refrain went on like a chant. Then, Vukotic witnessed a remarkable thing. His comrade started, as if suddenly waking up, and his eyes blazed with sparkles, spots and flashes of a purple colour. He had never seen anything like it, and some of the feeling he had felt during the encounter with the goblins returned, this time with a bottomless quality to it, as if something he had known and trusted was turning strange and unpredictable. Angrily, Muinchbeck shook his battle axe.
"Try to trance me, would you, wizard?"
Semperfilius seemed surprised by the mercenary's briefly changed appearance, but he stood his ground and became calm.
"I see that you too know of magic." "That's enough of that talk," Muinchbeck retorted in a blustering tone.
"As you wish," said Semperfilius. "Then I will pay you. In gold, good gold. For pity's sake, you must help me. In the name of all the gods, you cannot leave a child in the hands of those monsters."
Muinchbeck was inspecting him thoughtfully.
"Well, you are right," he said presently. "What he will suffer at their hands is scarcely thinkable. So, how many are there, and where are they?"
A great sigh of hope came from Semperfilius.
"If you continue your course, you will have to face them anyway, for they are less than a mile away. I think there are at least a couple of dozen of them."
Muinchbeck shook his head.
"That is too many. Can you not render yourself invisible?"
"I have no such powers, wizard," Muinchbeck told him. "You overrate me."
There is a confusion powder in my satchel, but the goblins have it."
"Well, Vukotic and I cannot kill that many goblins between us. That is certain."
Vukotic nodded agreement. The wizard bit his lip.
"I have gold, much gold in Talabheim."
"Gold will not kill them either,"
Vukotic put in.
"Especially if it is in Talabheim."
Semperfilius went down on his knees and wrung his hands as if in prayer.
"Save my son. There must be something we can do."
And all eyes turned to the elf, who had climbed the rock tor and was looking down on them.
"I will aid you,"
he said softly.
"That could turn the balance,"
Vukotic said.
"Yes," agreed Muinchbeck,
"especially with that bow of yours, elf."
"I?" The elf pulled out one of his arrows and balanced it on a finger. It seemed almost as long as a spear. "These are goblin killers."
"I will give you gold,"
Semperfilius promised.
"Gold?" the elf laughed.
"We will talk of payment later."
"Yes,
"Time enough for that," Moonchbeck said. "We'd best get moving, and hope your boy is still in one piece."
Despite the need for haste, Muinchbeck and Vukotich nevertheless found the opportunity to discuss payment for their services with the magician as they trudged the trail. They were to receive 150 gold Reichmarks and 200 gold eagles of the Kislev currency, roughly one-third now, and the rest when they had escorted him and his son to Talapheim. The elf had given his name as Cuolsh an Eshane, as near as Vukotich's ear could make it. From time to time, Vukotich glanced in his direction, wondering what payment the elf had in mind for his part in their enterprise. The smell of wood smoke reached them, which pleased Muinchbeck. It would mask their human odour. Semperphilius pointed and nodded. Gradually they worked their way through the woods until they looked down into a glade where the goblins had built a fire. The human boy they had was there too, a lad of about 7 years, stripped naked and bound to a frame made of staves cut from nearby trees. His face was slack and despairing, a grimace of fear. Two goblins were smearing mud and clay over his body in thick gobs.
"They mean to roast your son alive, magician," Vukotich murmured. "He's for their supper."
A low moan escaped Semperphilius's lips. Cuolsh an Eshane leaned close and whispered in a low voice like distant chimes.
"Here is our plan.
You two enter the glen, where the big oak grows, and attack. Your appearance will distract them, so they do not run for cover when my arrows start to fly. Be on your way now, and quietly."
The strategy seemed effective to Muinchbeck and Vukotich. Hearing the chortles and grunts of the goblins as they talked in their own ugly language, they made their way carefully down the slope and pushed through the undergrowth until they could peer through the foliage into the glade.
"All right," Muinchbeck said. "I'll lead. Keep close behind me. Cover my back. Use your sword to spit them before they reach their weapons."
Vukotich nodded. Through the wood smoke he caught the whiff of goblin sweat. Then they crashed their way into the open. Muinchbeck's broad back was ahead of him. The great battle axe flew, biting a goblin neck and laying it open so that the head flopped. The goblins were slow to respond at first, stopping to stare with looks of comic indignation. Vukotich jabbed one in the side with his sword, making a deep thrust. The creature responded by reaching for him, taloned fingers groping, and he slashed viciously at its arms until it fell back and limped away. Muinchbeck headed straight for the boy. A cudgel hurtled across the clearing, flung like a stick, and would have brained him had not Vukotich shoved him forward so that the missile passed between them and thudded into the earth. But now the goblins were rousing themselves and seizing their cudgels as well as long, jagged knives, and a veritable wall of death would have come upon the two humans had not a sound like a very high-pitched bee entered the glade and slim, light wooden shafts begun darting with incredible rapidity, one after the other, each finding its lump of green target. In only one case was Cuolsh an Eshane's aim deficient. A large goblin, wearing a helmet, charged at the pair of humans, waving its arms, an arrow through its head from ear to ear, uttering a peculiar growling wail. Muinchbeck was already occupied. Vukotich found himself in the goblin's embrace, fangs reaching for his neck, his sword wrenched from his grasp. He reached up with both hands, seized the implanted arrow on either side of his attacker's head, and tried to push it back, using all his strength. It was useless. The goblin's neck muscles were like a bull's. But a moment later, it slumped and fell away from Vukotich. Without his realizing it, his sword had gone right through the creature as it rushed at him. He planted a foot on the body
and pulled out the blade with difficulty. Suddenly, it was all over. The death of their leader panicked the remaining goblins, and they ran off into the woods. 7 dead or dying goblins lay in the clearing, 4 of them killed by the elf's arrows. The 2 mercenaries moved from corpse to corpse, making sure of them with their swords. Down the opposite bank, crashing through the undergrowth, with joyous abandon came Semperphilius the magician.
Reinir! Reinir!
Their grisly work finished. Vukotic stood by as Munchbeck freed the boy. His father caught him up in his arms in an ecstasy of relief. Tears coursed down his cheeks.
You are all right now. You are safe.
He began rubbing the mud off his son's body. The boy, for his part, remained dumb. He seemed numbed by his experience. Vukotic felt a hearty slap on his back.
We're doing well, Munchbeck said. 2 military encounters in one day. And as luck would have it, we're still alive. Well, how did you like it?
It was straightforward enough, Vukotic replied stiffly. Munchbeck laughed.
In time, you can even get a taste for it. The thought of dying can come to mean nothing to you.
He gestured and lowered his voice.
That young boy, though, will need a bit of care.
Yes, replied Vukotic automatically, though he wasn't much concerned. He saw Kowalsh unashamed ascend into the clearing.
Did you not think it risky to trust the elf?
He asked. What if he had simply left us to be slaughtered? Munchbeck shrugged.
Oh, an elf usually does what he says he'll do. It's in other ways you have to be careful. And our magician friend has maybe been a little rash in his need for help.
Before Vukotic could ask what he meant by that, Munchbeck had left his side, offering his water bottle to Semperphilius to clean the boy up a little. The 2 mercenaries searched the clearing and found the magician's satchel and Reiner's clothes, which had been ripped from him. Munchbeck then settled down cross-legged, and, with the sewing kit which Vukotic had learned every professional soldier carried with him, and which to his amusement Munchbeck called his housewife, set about stitching them back together. Before long, Reiner was clothed and seemed a little consoled, though he still said nothing. Munchbeck came to his feet.
We'd best not camp the night here. The gobos could return with more of their kind,
though I imagine none are too near.
Still, we'll put a mile or 2 between us and this place.
Wait, Kowalsh Anashane ordered calmly. He had been standing patiently by. There is something to be settled first. In answer to their quizzical stares, he continued.
My payment, of course.
Yes, of course, Semperphilius said fussily. What is it I can give you?
I will take the boy, Kowalsh Anashane said.
Semperphilius clutched Reiner to him and glared at the elf in alarm.
Come now. It is a fair exchange, Kowalsh Anashane reasoned. I have saved him from an early death, and one which would have been excruciatingly painful. Furthermore, you will be relieved of any anxiety on his behalf, for no more harm will befall him while in my ward.
Violently, Semperphilius shook his head.
No! No! Ask for something else!
There is nothing else I want or would ask. Your own kind you can pay with gold, but you cannot tempt an elf with riches, for we know how to gain all we need. It is no great pleasure for us to keep a child of your race, for human youth is such a passing thing. But I sense a special quality in this boy. He will be well cared for, and will learn something of elfcraft, which many humans covet.
No! Semperphilius thrust Reiner behind him. You shall not have him! He is mine! Begone, elf! Begone!
Wildly he looked to the two mercenaries. I have hired you. Protect us.
Vukotich frowned, but then Muinchbek looked doubtful and put his hands behind his back.
You hired the Ilf, too, he said. I see no reason to intervene if you break an agreement.
It was all too much for Reiner, who burst into tears. Vukotich looked questioningly at Muinchbek. The mercenary shrugged.
The boy will be all right with the elves, he said.
Vukotich could not understand such a disavowal of interest in the boy Muinchbek had just risked his life to rescue. He remembered how strange his eyes had looked only a short while ago. Was Muinchbek something other than he seemed? And was he simply afraid of Qualsh Anna Shane? What if Vukotich made a stand? Would he back him up, or leave him to his fate?
The boy has been through enough, said Vukotich, thinking of the rest of the money the magician had promised them. He belongs with his father.
Qualsh Anna Shane looked at him coolly. His elf eyes were so distant and unwavering, so disturbingly different from human eyes, that Vukotich felt unnerved. This is no concern of yours, the elf said in a silvery tone. It is between myself and the man who hired us.
Leave it alone, Vukotich, Muinchbek warned in a low voice. The elf can have the boy for all our care.
Vukotich took a watchful step back, half expecting the elf to make a move, to reach for the slim blade he carried in a delicately inlaid scabbard. But the elf only smiled. Perhaps he is a little too old after all. There is not much youth left in him. Without another word, he strolled to the north side of the clearing. In a moment, he had sidled into the forest and disappeared from view. Semperphilius closed his eyes and uttered a great shuddering sigh of thanks. But something of a sullen feeling descended between Vukotich and his companion. The magician's satchel proved to contain about 80 Kislev eagles and a few Reichmarks, as well as assorted files and little casks, wizards' appurtenances, Vukotich guessed, and some parchments. Muinchbek gave half the money to Vukotich, placed his own share in a thick leather purse he carried next to his body, and, somewhat reluctantly, Vukotich felt, returned the satchel and its remaining contents to Semperphilius. It was only then that the magician disclosed his route home. A day's journey back along the trail would bring them to a path south, which eventually led to a tributary of the River Rike. He knew a forest settlement on the banks of the river where a boat could be obtained. From there on, the journey should be easy, unless beset by river pirates. As agreed, they quit the goblin camp and made as much distance as they could before darkness proper fell. Muinchbek found them a hidden hollow well off the trail, shrouded by the branches of an ancient tree, and there he built a fire and produced some strips of dried venison for their supper. It was not till then, once they had settled, that Vukotich noticed the tension between the two men, bordering on enmity. At first he thought it hardly surprising, seeing that Muinchbek had refused to oppose the elf's claim to Reiner, but it emerged there was more to it. It began with shadowboxing, in all apparent innocence, and Muinchbek politely inquiring if Semperphilius was a native of Kislev.
No. I am of the Empire, the magician said. I moved to Kislev for safety. There was such trouble in the Empire, and I had my son to think of.
He glanced fondly at where Reiner, exhausted, lay sleeping, his blonde curls gleaming in the firelight. But now that the uprising is finished and things have settled down, I decided to move back, especially as Kislev is arming itself for war now, and who knows how that will end. Why, those who stand over us want to imperil us with their wars, I do not know.
Pardon me. I had forgotten that you, too, are a man of war.
Your accent escapes me, Muenchbeck remarked casually, as though the matter was barely worth a mention. Native Rockspiel, I suppose. But which province? It seems unlike any I have ever heard, and I thought I knew them all.
Semperphilius poked the fire with a stick and assumed an air of boredom.
When I was young, we moved from town to town a good deal. My parents were strolling magicians. I was never in one place long enough to acquire a regional accent. Yours is plain to me, however.
True. You can never mistake a Marienburger.
The two fell silent, and Vukotich chose that moment to seek to satisfy his own curiosity.
I have never met a magician before, he said to Semperphilius. Does it take a long time to become one? What magic can you work?
You have never met a magician before. Semperphilius widened his eyes, looking first to Vukotich and then to Muenchbeck with mock incredulity.
Magic! Has your mentor taught you none?
He spoke the word mentor scathingly, as though it were an insult.
You mistake us, Muenchbeck said, before Vukotich could respond. The only thing Vukotich is learning from me is soldiering, nothing more. Neither am I an adept or even an apprentice, as you seem to suppose.
Then perhaps the case is worse, the magician said. For you have meddled with the dark powers, those which the foolish who have wrapped themselves in seductions delude themselves into thinking light and brilliance.
Sensing the wary look on Vukotich's face, Muenchbeck turned to him.
Vukotich, our friend is going to tell you that there are different kinds of magic. Some based on benign, natural forces and on the lawful gods, and others that draw on wild forces from beyond this world, on demons and unimaginable powers. Powers of what is called chaos. Semperphilius would have us believe he practices the first kind, which is difficult and takes long study and training. The second kind is comparatively easy, but wildly dangerous. However, the truth is...
What kind do you practice, Muenchbeck?
Vukotich demanded to know. The wild kind? Is that why you could smell the goblins?
Munchbeck's reply was clipped, as if he hadn't wanted his ability mentioned.
When I was a young man, I fell in with a secret cult in Marienburg, but only for a short time, till I realized the dangers. I know no magic as such, can work no spells, but when you come into contact with chaos, you sometimes receive small gifts, such as my heightened senses. So, I can do what I can do.
Munchbeck's ability interested Vukotich, and he must have shown it, for Semperphilius pointed a finger at him and spoke in a voice harsh with warning.
Young man, you are in danger. The wild power of chaos brings only evil and destruction. Your companion admits he is tainted by it, and will lead you to your doom. What care has he for you?
Enough of it, growled Muenchbeck, his anger beginning to show.
Our arrangement doesn't give you leave to act like a priest.
Vukotich, for his part, felt duty bound to side with his comrade in arms, and thought of a retort to make to Semperphilius.
Well, wizard, you didn't object when I went with Muenchbeck to rescue the boy from the goblins.
But he had already begun to question his partnership with the other man. No one seemed willing to converse further, and with the hooting of nocturnal birds in their ears, they all settled down in a somewhat surly mood, to sleep. Next morning, Muinchbek disappeared at dawn, taking Vukotic's bow and quiver with him, and returned an hour later with a deer calf he had shot. This he expertly butchered and cut the best part of the meat into strips, which he roasted quickly over the revitalized fire. So they breakfasted, stuffed what was left into their travel satchels, and went on their way. Sleep had given Reiner a remarkable recovery, outwardly at least. Vukotic found him to be a lively lad, though somewhat naive and unknowledgeable even for his age. His upbringing, he guessed, had been unusually sheltered. The day turned out sunny, and Reiner chatted guilelessly to him as they went along. But when they started to scout further ahead among the trees, Semperphilius objected to Reiner being out of sight, and anxiously called them back. They took a southwards path towards the end of the day's march, and camped in a ravine through which it passed. Next day, early in the afternoon, the sound of running water became audible, and they came upon a smallish river, which Semperphilius called the Clyflush. It was again growing dark when, making their way along its left bank, they found the hamlet he had promised. It was deserted, a huddle of huts which appeared not to have been inhabited for some time. The disappointed magician tutted and fussed until Reiner, exploring on the other side of the wretched settlement, uncovered a boat moored among the reeds. It was just large enough to hold the four of them, and had one oar missing. Muinchbek selected a branch from a nearby tree, lopped it off, and spent half an hour using his battle-axe to rough-hew a replacement from the unseasoned timber. "Best we stay here for the night," Muinchbek announced. Vukotic agreed.
"At least there'll be a roof over our heads for a change."
The area around the hamlet was pleasantly wooded, the undergrowth not dense. For only the second time since their meeting, the magician condescended to demonstrate his skill. Off in the distance, where glimmers of fading sunlight still penetrated the tree cover, a pair of large and plump game birds, of a type Vukotic had not seen before, with speckled feathers, were perched on a tree branch. They were almost out of arrow shot, but he decided to try for one of them, and strung an arrow to his bow, pacing slowly forward to try to get closer.
Semperphilius tapped him on the shoulder,
put a finger to his lips to caution silence, and waved him aside. The magician then extended his right arm in the direction of the two fowl, hand outstretched with the fingers slightly apart. His face and body grew rigid, eyes staring like a madman's, and he seemed, though Vukotic was not sure, to murmur an incantation. After a while of what seemed intense mental effort on his part, the fowl took to the air. Vukotic thought they had lost them, but no. In leisurely fashion, they flapped beneath the boughs and flew straight towards the magician to alight almost at his feet. He bent, snatched up each bird by the neck, one in each hand. He straightened and raised his catch in triumph. "Tasty dish for supper!" Suddenly, Semperphilius froze. His eyes narrowed. He seemed to be peering into the forest.
"The elf is following us," he muttered. "He still wants Reiner."
"How do you know?" Vukotic asked him.
"I know."
After dusk, when they had eaten, Semperphilius spent some time laying a magical protection around the hut, taking Reiner with him. Told of the wizard's fears, Muinchbek professed the same disinterest as before.
"I've told you, the elf can have the boy for all our care," he said.
Vukotic made no comment to that, surprised though he felt at his companion's attitude. Instead, he changed the subject.
"Is it true there are different colours of magic?"
Muinchbek nodded casually.
"I believe there are 8 colleges, each with its own colour.
Wizards from the colour colleges can be distinguished by their dress and totems, without which their magic is useless. I think our friend belongs to the Grey College. The dagger and arrow designs on his cloak and hat are special symbols of theirs. Grey wizards travel a lot, and be too free with their advice. They are also said to be unreliable. He paused and went on thoughtfully. Listen, Vakatich. What we were talking about last night, about the different kind of magic. Don't take too much notice of what Semperphilius tells you. The truth is that all magic comes from chaos, ultimately. No one kind is better than another. Magicians like Semperphilius' kind rail against chaos gods and demons, and they are wise to do it. But all magic is dangerous. It imperils the soul. Just then, Semperphilius and his son returned to the hut, the wizard sweating with his efforts, and the two mercenaries lapsed into silence. That night, as he lay sleeping, Vukotic dreamed that he was a game fowl, such as he had eaten that evening. He had a speckled brown body and long tail feathers, streaked brown and green, which trailed behind him as he flew. In his dream, the rigid face of the magician appeared, as though carved from wood, the eyes like glass, and in a loud voice ordered Vukotic to fly through a cave made of tree boughs. The moment the voice stopped, Vukotic's neck was seized in a fist which choked the life out of him while he dangled. But it was not Semperphilius's fist. It was Muinchbeck's. His companion was laughing, eyes sparkling and luminescing as when they had met the magician. He was laughing at Vukotic, at how easily he was led, laughing in triumph before tossing away his limp body. Vukotic awoke with a start, sweating. He was in the hut. The sun was high, its rays slanting down through the chinks between the logs where the mud and moss had fallen out. How could he have slept so long? By his side, Muinchbeck was snoring, grumbling fitfully in his slumber. Vukotic looked to his other side. Rainer was not there.
Neither was his father.
Muinchbeck came awake with a shout when Vukotic shook him. We've overslept, and the wizard and the boy are gone. What? Muinchbeck jumped to his feet, making the cabin seem tiny with his bulk, and realizing what time of day it was, glared wildly about him. His glance jumped to the wall near which their heads had lain and where they had leaned their weapons to be handy to grab in an emergency. His battle axe, Vukotic's bow and arrows, and both their swords. All were gone. With a bellow he dashed outside, Vukotic following more slowly. The boat's gone too, Muinchbeck announced brusquely, together with our employers, needless to say. He paced up and down. It was I who prepared the food, and I don't think he had a chance to put anything in it, so it wasn't that. Tell me, did you dream you saw Semperphilius's face in the night? Vukotic nodded. Yes, I did. I dreamt he turned me into a bird.
So did I.
That was it then. He reached into our sleeping minds with his mental power, and made us sleep deeper and longer so he could make off with no trouble. He couldn't trance me in a waking state, but when you're asleep, it's different. Vukotic only grunted. He and Muinchbeck had played their part. Once on the river, there was little danger, certainly none from goblins. The magician and his son would soon float into more settled areas of the empire and be perfectly safe. And Semperphilius would get out of paying them the rest of their agreed fee.
Did he steal your share of the money? He asked. He still had his. He'd already checked.
Muenchbek reached beneath his jerkin and brought out his purse, which was fastened round his waist by a chain. He unfastened an elaborate clasp, opened it, and ran his fingers through the contents, jingling coins. "Not unless he's making me see, hear, and feel what's not there," he returned the purse. "And I'd know if he were trying a trick like that. Perhaps he couldn't take it from you without waking you." Muenchbek lowered his eyes, as if thinking a thought he did not want to voice. "I expect that's it," he said flatly. "Or perhaps it wasn't the money," Vukotic thought to himself. "Perhaps Semperphilius wanted to get away from Muenchbek. Away from the taint of chaos."
The mercenary was in a temper. "That magician, a fine one he is,
with his talk of law and righteousness. Just what you might expect from a thief and a cheat."
He reached behind him, under his jerkin, and brought out a long, broad-bladed knife.
"I still have this at any rate."
He glared at Vukotic.
"We're carrying on down the river. Come on, there's work to do."
Soon Muenchbek was labouring like a bullock, short of tools as he was. First he found a piece of felled tree trunk which, with Vukotic's help, he used as a battering ram to demolish two of the huts. From the ruins he selected a pile of logs, which they collected together on the river bank. Then he ran into the forest and was gone for quite a long time. When he returned, he trailed behind him a great mass of creeper, which he had cut for use as rope. They set to work binding the logs together in two layers, one laid at right angles to the other. By midday, they had built a raft large enough to carry them both, though Vukotic wondered what its chances were of holding together if it collided with an obstruction. Tethering it to a sapling, they pushed the raft onto the river. Muenchbek stepped aboard and jumped up and down to test its buoyancy, watching it dip and bounce in the water. He pronounced himself satisfied and gestured to Vukotic.
"Come on, let's get going."
But Vukotic hung back.
"What do you intend to do now?"
"Go after our money, of course, and the reckoning with the magician."
"Is it worth it?"
Vukotic asked.
"We still have the money he gave us.
And there's quite a lot.
And maybe there's no more gold to be had from him. We could go on to Kislev, or even back to..."
He stopped. In truth, he too wanted to go after Semperphilius. Apart from the money, the wizard had taken his weapons. But he did not really want to go anywhere with Muenchbek any more. The bluff, affable man, who had been so staunch and dependable, now seemed unpredictable, with weird and disturbing properties. Briefly, Muenchbek considered the proposal. Then he shook his head vigorously.
"We carry on,
down the river."
"No,
you are. I'm not coming."
Muenchbek glowered.
"Not coming? What in Manon's name do you mean?" "I just don't trust you any more. Perhaps there is something wrong with you. Perhaps you're tainted after all. I helped you build your raft, and you can have my share of the money. But I'm going to Kislev."
The two men faced up to each other, barely suppressing their antagonism. Vukotic did not relish having to confront his comrade. Though they were nearly evenly matched now, Muenchbek had over 20 years more experience. Abruptly, Muenchbek held up a hand and began to sniff the air.
"Goblins," he announced. "There smells on the breeze again."
Vukotic turned, just in time to catch a glimpse of a green shape moving through the trees. Muenchbek had seen it too.
"Well," he said, "are you still going to try to walk out of here on your own?"
For an answer, Vukotic clambered onto the raft. Muenchbek loosed the mooring
and poled them into the current. Behind them, a group of green-skinned figures, perhaps 10 in number, emerged from the forest. One raised its cudgel and howled in frustration. The raft drifted on down the river, leaving the goblins far behind. Once they were out of sight, Munchbeck threw Vukotic a fierce look.
"I'm still going after the magician."
Vukotic made no answer, just shrugged. Munchbeck threw back his head and laughed. Was it just a reflection of the sunlight sparkling on the water? Or did Munchbeck's eyes shine with those unearthly lights as they had before? Vukotic remembered the magician's warning and the dream of Munchbeck squeezing the life out of him with his massive fist. He settled down on the other side of the raft, from where Munchbeck was doing his best to control its motion with a crudely made paddle, and neither spoke as the river bore them away. Munchbeck tossed him some strips of dried meat, which they both washed down with river water. At about mid-afternoon, he shouted to Vukotic to take up the pole. He had spotted a jetty, and behind it a tidy thatched roof village. Vukotic reminded Munchbeck that Semperphilius was making for Talibheim.
"Talibheim is where he said he lives," Munchbeck replied. "What reason have we to believe him?"
With difficulty, they managed to bump their craft against the timbers of the jetty and tied it up there. Vukotic followed Munchbeck onto the dirt track that wound through the village. Few people were about. Children played outside the doors of their houses. From one door a woman peered out, dragged her children inside and slammed it. Munchbeck beckoned a small boy who approached curiously.
"Have you a Master Semperphilius living here?"
"Semperphilius the magician."
The child stared dumbly and only shook his head when Vukotic asked,
"Do you know a boy called Reiner?"
Munchbeck sighed.
"Well, it seems an unlikely place after all. Let's get going."
They took to the river again, and, as afternoon wore on, passed a stretch of forest charred and blackened by fire, from which green buds were by now beginning to appear. Further on was evidence of a battle, possibly related to the fire. Rusted casks and cuirasses, horse skeletons and tumbled bombards. This gave Munchbeck food for thought, for Semperphilius had said he fled the civil strife, during which Talibheim had not been threatened as far as he had heard. His interest was aroused when they swept round a bend in the river and saw another jetty, this time with a more sizable town belonging to it. Boats lined the jetty, leaving no room for their raft, so they contrived to ground it a few yards upriver. Wading through the marshy rushes, Munchbeck suddenly stopped and picked up a fragment of timber, then another. He inspected the area, noting how the rushes had recently been flattened.
"Someone has smashed a boat up here. Most of it must have been thrown into the river."
He scanned the boats tied to the jetty. The magician's was not among them. Possibly he held a piece of it in his hand. If Semperphilius had tried to destroy the evidence of his presence, then he had failed. Munchbeck strode into the village, Vukotic following him. Many of the houses here were slate-roofed, and beyond the outskirts were cultivated fields where the forest had been cleared. A tavern stood at the end of the main street. He headed straight for it. The shadows were long. The sun would soon vanish behind the tops of the trees. A musty smell greeted them as they entered the inn's taproom. It was too early for customers, and the landlord was polishing pewter tankards. He looked wary at the entry of such a stranger as Munchbeck.
"Welcome to Gladbeach," he said,
when he had served them two measures of foamy beer.
"Will you be staying long?"
Munchbeck drained his tankard in one go and wiped the foam from his beard before he answered.
We are here on behalf of one of your neighbours, a Master Semperphilius. Be good enough to direct us to his house.
The landlord looked about to deny all knowledge of Semperphilius, but Muinchbeck was looking directly into his face, and Vukotich, for the second time that day, had the feeling of a formidable power issuing from his eyes. At any rate, the landlord thought better than to lie.
"Ah, you mean Dr. Semperphilius, the learned gentleman. His house is a mile along the road into the forest, but you will not find him there. He left for foreign parts more than a year ago." Impatiently, Muinchbeck gestured to Vukotich to finish his beer or leave it, and stalked out. Well, Vukotich reasoned, he'd come this far. He might as well see this business through. Kislev could wait. He drained his beer and went after the other man. As they paced the winding path into the forest with dusk falling around them, Vukotich asked himself what the magician might do against them. If he simply gave them their fee, all well and good. But what if he decided to try a spell? And then there was Muinchbeck and his own strange powers. How far could he trust the man? It was with that thought in his mind that they came upon the wizard's house. It was set back from the road, almost hidden among the foliage of screening trees, so that a casual passer-by might well have missed it. Constructed of stout timbers and fitted with windows of coloured glass, it plainly belonged to a man of means. Muinchbeck did not approach straight away, but drew Vukotich behind some bushes and watched the building. Vukotich realized that he was waiting for darkness. He intended to enter uninvited. A light came on within. Muinchbeck appeared ready to move.
"Semperphilius has mental powers," Vukotich whispered. "Won't he know we're breaking in?" "I think his attention might be too preoccupied at this moment," Muinchbeck replied enigmatically, and moved off through the trees. They skirted the house, approaching from the rear through an overgrown garden. There was a back door of solid, thick planking, which proved to be bolted from within. Muinchbeck sidled to a shuttered window and went to work with his knife, so expertly as to make Vukotich believe he had been a burglar at some time in his career. He prized out several small glass panels, scraped at the surrounding, and ended by quietly wrenching loose the frame and pushing in the shutters. They climbed through with only a subdued scuffling for noise. They had entered a small room used as a library, piled and littered with books and scrolls. Muinchbeck opened the door, and both men stepped through. Here the gloom was lessened. Sconces in the walls of a passage further off had been lit. Vukotich hesitated, trying to guess the layout of the building. Then a long, piercingly high-pitched wail of utter despair sounded through the house, coming from somewhere ahead and a little above. Vukotich recognized the voice. It was Reiner's. It galvanized them both into action, blundering along a corridor and finding a stairway which they mounted three steps at a time. At the top, Muinchbeck threw open a door. Vukotich followed him through. They were on a gallery overlooking a large, brightly lit room. Below was an utterly bewildering scene. Reiner lay bound to a low table, or altar. Incense burned in crucibles on either side of him. Behind his head, a purple flame poured up from a huge, peculiarly shaped candle. His face was a mask of terror, just as when he had been a prisoner of the goblins, but this time his frightened expression was mingled with disbelief, for, standing over him, a long, wavy-bladed knife held over his heart in two hands, was his own father. Semperphilius was clad in a cloak of dark grey, and a tall iron crown studded with blood-red gems.
He seemed unaware of the entry of the intruders, for he was deep in mental concentration, and the face which looked down on his son was as pitiless as a raptor's.
"No! Father! No!"
Reiner shrieked. Vuketich shouted in astonishment as Muinchbeck took out his own knife, and in the same motion hurled it straight at the boy. As the knife flew through the air, Vuketich realized that Muinchbeck had thrown the knife hilt first. He was not trying to kill Reiner. Then the knife struck the boy on the head and knocked him unconscious. Semperphilius, haggard of face, backed up against a wall.
"There is no need for this," he said harshly to Muinchbeck. "I will pay you any sum you ask."
"I don't want gold," Muinchbeck grumbled. "I want the boy."
"No,"
the magician shook his head vigorously.
"I will make you as wealthy as a prince. I will teach you magical secrets."
The conversation was mystifying to Vuketich.
"What in Tal's name is going on?"
he demanded. For answer, Muinchbeck pointed to Semperphilius. His voice was angry.
"Take a look at this magician, Vuketich. Look at this loving father. Well, I'll tell you a tale. How old would you say he is? About 40, would you say? But see, isn't his face already a little bit more lined than when you last set eyes on him? Well, he isn't 40. He's very old, perhaps as much as 1,000 years.
The magician's face now turned ugly as Muinchbeck went on.
"There are ways to become immortal. There are champions of chaos that live in the realms of the chaos powers, but they are no longer human. You can become a vampire, one of the undead, but that is a living death. Now, our friend wanted to enjoy life forever as a normal human being, to stay reasonably young indefinitely. Well, there is a foul way to do that. Every time the adept begins to age, he must sacrifice a child and absorb its youth, its life forces into his body. But not just any child will do. It must be between 6 and 12 years of age, and the same sex as the recipient. Most important, the operation will not work at all unless the child is the magician's own child."
Muinchbeck's eyes smouldered.
"That's why Semperphilius was always so anxious about the boy. It was his own life he was protecting. He reached the time when he needs to make the infusion, so he's come back here, where he has his magical apparatus and the special herbs and drugs to assist the transfer of life force. I can smell goblins far off, and I smelled something about him too. I smelled age on him. He was far older than he looked. Then there was the business of his speech. Centuries ago, when he first learned Rockspiel, people spoke it differently. And he's never lost the accent."
Vuketich glanced at the still unconscious boy.
"Why did you knock Reiner out? For the ceremony to work, the child has to know what's happening to him. That's the nastiest part of all, perhaps. With the boy unconscious, Semperphilius would have killed him for nothing."
"Then I was wrong about you."
"Yes, Vuketich. You have to trust your comrades if you're a soldier, and not listen to old men you meet in the forest, especially grey wizards, known for their unreliability."
He took a step forward, clenching his fists.
"Every 20 years or so, this wizard sires a son, only for the purpose of slaughtering him like a pig somewhere around his 9th birthday. How many of your children have you murdered down the years, wizard? How many? Well, it's over now,
We're taking your boy away, and you can die a natural death, as the gods intended.
The magician still held the sacrificial knife in one hand. His eyes went sidelong, directing their attention to a design above the doorway at the end of the room. An 8-pointed star.
There is the emblem of pure chaos. When I was an apprentice, there were no colour colleges. There was only magic. But that was a long time ago.
While their gaze was averted, he casually reached out with his free arm. There was an inset shelf and an open cask upon it. Suddenly he had flung aloft a handful of coloured ash, which flared like gunpowder, turning into a cloud which surrounded Muinchbeck. In that cloud, giant pythons writhed, threatening to devour him. How easily Semperphilius had turned the situation around. The fog dispersed in seconds, but Muinchbeck was clearly confused and did not know where he was, while the wizard had fully recovered. He began intoning words in a strange language, which hardly seemed like speech at all, its syllables striking the air like hammers. Muinchbeck's eyes sparked and spat golden light, but he was no match for Semperphilius now. His back arched, his arms spread as if forced up by another. Semperphilius let out a stentorian bellow.
Die!
And Muinchbeck began to topple. Suddenly, Vukotic spotted the knife Muinchbeck had thrown at Reiner, gleaming on the floor in the lamplight. He snatched it up and ran straight for Semperphilius. The wizard parried the lunge with his sacrificial blade. To Vukotic's dazed mind, that blade became a dozen two-handed swords, while his own punny knife became red-hot in his hand, forcing him to drop it with a pained cry. Then the prick of the wizard's knife point was at his throat, and he heard the wizard laugh. Vukotic was only vaguely aware that the door had opened to admit a green-clad figure with pointed ears and honeyed skin. A figure which leapt to his side with astonishing speed. A slim silver sword flashed as it entered Semperphilius's chest. The wizard made a peculiar sound, a sort of gulp. His eyes rolled back in their sockets. His arms seemed to flap as he fell to the floor. The mind-dazzling mist of magic dissipated. Vukotic could see clearly again. He saw who his rescuer was. It was the elf, Cuolsch Anna Shane.
Then you were following us.
Calmly, the elf cleaned his sword blade. Following you? I was ahead of you much of the time. Elves do not need to sleep as much as you do. Yes, I followed you into the house, for which you should be grateful. Now Muinchbeck was climbing groggily to his feet.
I had an idea you knew what was happening, he said.
Distantly, Cuolsch Anna Shane nodded. I can sense age, and the wizard was too old for a human. I guessed at the method he was using, and decided to save the boy if I could. Well, I have preserved his life for a second time, and I claim him as my reward. You cannot deny me. Vukotic stared past Cuolsch Anna Shane. The magician was rising to his feet. He was tearing apart its vestments and mouthing incantations, glaring at the wound made by the elf's sword. New skin was forming over the incision, like a mouth closing. The wound healed up. And from out of the wizard's mouth there burst a ball, an expanding bubble, a sparkling miasma of pure magic. It engulfed Cuolsch Anna Shane. The elf seemed to cavort as he struggled in the nimbus, wrapped in tendrils of light as if struck by lightning. Vukotic's vision wavered. On the floor lay the sacrificial knife dropped by Semperphilius.
Munchbeck was still confused and would not act straight away. In a few seconds, the elf would be dead, but the wizard's attention was still engaged on his spell. He could attack. He snatched up the sinuous knife, plunged it into the body of the wizard. The knife scraped bone. He felt the meaty sensation of flesh being penetrated. He wrenched out the knife and stepped back. There was an endless moment, and Semperphilius screamed.
No! No!
He gabbled the arcane tongue again, but his strength was used up. Shaking his head in disbelief that this could happen, Semperphilius collapsed to his hands and knees, then sagged until he lay face down on the floor, his cloak covering him. The magic ball in which he had trapped the elf fading away, as life left his form. Vuketich stepped forward and turned the body over with his foot. Munchbeck came up beside him.
He's done for this time, thank Menin.
The lifeless face had already aged about 50 years.
I dare say there's much gold hereabouts, buried nearby, maybe, said Munchbeck thoughtfully. But there's no knowing what type of magical traps are set over it. We'd best give it a miss.
Kowalsh Anashane was standing motionless, eyes closed, seemingly in a coma, his face unusually pale. He had not yet recovered from the magical nimbus, Vuketich realized. Now was the time to decide what happened to the boy. Munchbeck saw what was in his mind. He placed a hand on Vuketich's shoulder and spoke in a low voice.
Let the lad go with the elf. He'll be much better off. What can we do? We're on our way to fight wars for Kislev.
Vuketich looked from Munchbeck to the elf and back again. He shrugged.
You're right. He'd only slow us down.
Munchbeck chuckled softly.
To most people, law is good and chaos is evil. But it's not that simple. Followers of law can be evil. And sometimes there is good in chaos. After all, magic is derived from it, of whatever school. Still, chaos is a temptation to be resisted. Steep yourself in it, and you're doomed, because no human being can control it in the end. You'll end up not even human.
He paused.
Vuketich, you remind me of myself at your age. There's something about you. I feel sure that you'll come up against chaos sooner or later. You must understand it before you can resist it.
Vuketich didn't know whether to be flattered or insulted. Suddenly, the elf opened his eyes, and he felt their cool, too distant stare upon him. That stare told him that Kowalsh Anashane had heard everything they had said.
You choose wisely, Kowalsh Anashane said. A life among elves is better than your dull lives. It will be a delight to care for him. A human child is like a flower to us. It blossoms so briefly. But let us make sure the boy is unhurt.
On the altar, Reiner was stirring. Vuketich saw the purple bruise the knife hilt had made on his temple. The elf began to untie the ropes that bound him.
Once he is in our company, he will forget his old life, said Kowalsh Anashane, gazing down on his prize.
He aided Reiner to sit up. The boy raised his face to his rescuers.
Why did my father try to kill me?
He asked plaintively. None of them had the heart to answer.
White Dwarf 140, from August of 1991, features a multi-page run explaining the content of, and the vision behind, the Warhammer fiction line. That this should appear at this moment is strange, considering that, according to the Freedom in an Owned Universe article, 2 months later, David Pringle, the editor for the line at this stage, was made redundant, and the line would appear in jeopardy. So, why were they giving them this big push? Even stranger in this context is that the article contains a timeline of the Warhammer world that places the fiction in the context of the wider Warhammer story. I say that, but apart from the Siege of Prague and Karl Franz becoming Emperor, there weren't any canonical events in the Warhammer world timeline apart from the stuff in the novels. But in the timeline, there appeared a reference to 7 pieces of fiction that would never appear as official GW book publications. These stories were Blood and Earth, a novella by Nicola Griffith, who wrote The Other and The Voyage South, The Magician's Son, which we have just listened to, The Black Sail by Steve McIntosh, who wrote the story Seed of Doubt for Deathwing and would appear in White Dwarf 142, a Gotrek and Felix story not written by Bill King but by John Brunner, which GW would eventually release as an e-book, Who Mourns the Necromancer by Brian Craig that would eventually appear in Inferno, The Manchador Affair by Gwyneth Jones, which appears to be entirely lost to us apart from a one-sentence summary in this article, and Jack Yeovil's Warhawk, that would be published as part of a series of Genevieve books. 7 named stories. And also, at the end of the story we have just read, which was published in White Dwarf 136, we were told that a new anthology was coming, which included many of these named authors and William King. What the King story was is a complete mystery. It seems sensible that it might have been Skaven's Claw, which was published in White Dwarf 152-153, but, according to the intro to the Troll Slayer anthology, King said that this was meant to be part of a Gotrek and Felix book alone, along with Mark of Slaanesh and Blood and Darkness, presumably much as Genevieve got her own book of novellas later on. So there is a missing King story there. And, as John Brunner already had a Gotrek and Felix story in the collection, I think it might have featured different protagonists. I'm going to try and get in touch with King at some point and ask him about this. It is interesting to note that these lost stories really seem to have leaned into the idea that the characters created by the Warhammer authors were pooled. We'd already seen this with Steve Baxter being asked to take over the Sam Warble character in The Song, but here we have John Brunner taking over Gotrek and Felix, Stephen from The Other appearing in The Black Sail, something Griffith had no idea had happened when I told her about it, and here Vuketich appearing again in an even younger form. I really like that Vuketich keeps getting younger in every story, and that this might have eventually led to a Spielberg Kids on Bikes or even Muppet Babies-style version of Vuketich. Interestingly, in the White Dwarf 140 timeline, the summary of The Magician's Son has Munchbeck knocking around with someone called Hallam, who is a character from the unpublished Nicola Griffith story. This raises the possibility that it was decided at publication point to shift the character to Vuketich, who had greater name recognition. Or it could be a typo. But the timeline has Vuketich working for the von Mecklenburgs and being 53 years old by this point, so I think the intent was that the character was someone else for much of the story's development. Freedom in an Owned World talks a lot about the top-down directives coming through to the stories, and I wonder if this character shift was one of them, because the background information we get about Vuketich in this story is not un-Vuketich-like, but at the same time, he's a little bit of a blank audience surrogate compared to the irascible 30-year-old and the stoic 50-year-old we have seen in other stories. So many mysteries to investigate. I feel like an Awesome Lies blog.
Let's turn to the story itself. It's a story that is very interested in the interlocking of chaos and magic, and those closing lines about law and chaos and good and evil are really interesting ones, although they are ideas I'd like to have seen explored a little more. I think Muenbeck's superpowers, giving us a little bit of the old partially corrupted but not wholly bad, is fun and gives us another way in which we can think about the nature of chaos. There's a real focus on magic as a kind of psychic phenomenon, rather than the body horror of a Jack Yeovil mutant, and this focus on it as an unpredictable energy source I think reflects Bailey's background as a sci-fi writer, in contrast to Yeovil's horror background. Much like we saw in The Spells Below, I think there was a push from GW that colour college magic would be the way forward. Awesome Lies has an excellent article on the development of this idea I would really recommend for more detail, but suffice to say that, by 1989, the push was on to replace the old generic magic system with one based on the colour wheel of colleges. This would have come too late for the first wave of books, but would have been very current as the second wave were being written, and would have been reinforced by their featuring heavily in Advanced HeroQuest's magic system. So, Semperphilius was not only a grey wizard, but also a grey wizard whose magic influenced his behaviour and manner. The discussion between Muenbeck and Semperphilius about the nature of magic was a lot of fun, and I liked the conceit that Muenbeck's magic is more unsettling in its nature, but Semperphilius's is ultimately more evil. There is the elephant in the room, however, that this story, just like The Spells Below, focuses on a wizard trying to unnaturally preserve their lifespan and being an asshole in the process. This is, of course, fine for a setting that draws on tropes, and it's all very Lovecraft and Howard, I suppose, but I'm surprised it didn't get picked up in editing. Well, perhaps we were going to find out that immortality was the racket behind all magic. You were going to have all these wildly different colleges, but whatever their aesthetic, they also all had an unpleasant way of making sure they lived forever. I am of the Amber College. I cast nature magic, and am in tune with the wild. I can camouflage myself, or turn into a bear. But don't look in my basement, because it's full of the remains of delivery men I've kidnapped and melted down to make an exfoliating skin scrub that will make me look 21 forever. I also quite liked the description of the goblins. A bit like with the elf, there was an effort to make the non-human races feel alien in some respect, and the idea that they smell different, particularly before goblinoids are defined as being fungoid in nature, was a fun way to do that. At the same time, the goblins sounded really tough and muscly, and it felt like Bailey hadn't really engaged with the what's an orc and what's a goblin differences. I think the malicious children feel of goblins is so embedded into those who are familiar with the war game via the miniatures, perhaps it doesn't read quite the same way if you only have Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay to go on. It's not really there if you look them up in the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay Beastery, which pegs them as being between 4 and 6 feet in height. On the subject of non-humans, what did we think of the elves here? No one really wants to get to grips with these guys, I suspect because they just seem so Tolkien-esque with very little added to them. The sea elves had their moment as creepy rich guys in The Song, but this is an elf of the sort that took in Orfeo, and it doesn't give us very much sense of what the deal is with these guys. Although there's a certain coolness to all of his dealings that probably worked quite well, I didn't find myself convinced these guys really do find human children interesting. The boy's going to end up with Orfeo's inferiority complex. Actually, I did find myself dashing to the timeline to work out if he was Orfeo, but obviously he's not for like 6 different reasons. To finish, I suppose I'd like to talk about some of the choices I made in the reading. This is a story that talks about accents, and required me to make choices that reflected that. Muenchbeck tells us that the Marienburger accent is distinctive and instantly recognisable, so how to deliver that? I toyed with him having a New York accent, but then was rather drawn to the idea that Marienburgers are Dutch, but Muenchbeck is also really into fighting and slightly chaos-maddened, and so some sort of South African Afrikaans vibe was born. With Semperphilius, we are told he has an accent that only existed in the Reichland 1,000 years ago, so I began thinking that that would be some sort of Middle English Chaucer-style thing, but because he isn't written speaking that way, I chose to keep the idea of the sing-song sound of Middle English, but then bodied it out with Welsh, the logic being if he was 1,000 years old and this story is set in an analogy for the 15th century of Europe, then the version of English that he speaks, which stands in here for the native language of the empire, would be whatever people in Britain were speaking before the Germanic people arrived in the British Isles, and that would be a bit like Welsh, but a Welsh with a bit of Chaucer to it at times. It doesn't have a great deal of internally consistent logic to it, but in the end, I think the voices match the characters quite well, and I suppose that's the name of the game, really. Please feel free to comment on the show in the posts in the Oldhammer, Rogue Trader, or Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay First Edition Facebook groups, or to leave a review if you are so inclined. Please tell friends if this is the type of thing that might interest them. You could also follow me on Twitter, where I post at Lewis Kerno about, well, history, the podcast, RPGs, miniatures, and Turnip28. And I've also now got a Blue Sky profile under the name of the Oldhammer Fiction Podcast. Check me out there, it's quite a nice vibe. Next time will be our Christmas special, and who knows better how to keep you feeling festive during a long holiday journey than a gang of green hooligans. Yes, folks, next time we're going to be reading the entirety of War Orcs.